Okay, welcome back to the Eyes of Our Brothers, Shear, to Yosef Part 2. We began speaking last week about Yosef, who is a fascinating character on so many levels, and in particular because we know so much about him, or at least we think we do. We've learned about him since we were very young, but there is much more than meets the eye when it comes to Yosef, obviously. And in particular, we spoke about the idea last week that he, more than any of the other sons at the outset, he was born into a very beautiful environment. His family loved him, his mother and his father cared so deeply for him. A little unclear if his brothers, what his brothers thought about him, or rather what he thought his brothers thought about him. It seems to be that a possibility that he might not have realized how much they disliked him until we get to where we're starting from this week, and that is the mechira of Yosef, the sale when his brothers sold him. And if he didn't realize before then that his brothers didn't like him, then it probably serves to reason that he realized that they did not like him once they sold him into slavery. But the truth is, when it comes to Yosef, it's fascinating that when we're speaking about the mechira, you'd think that it's an important topic to cover in his life, but there's not much to talk about, and that is because of the fact that he does not say a word, he does not make any movements, he does nothing in the entirety of the story of the Mechira. And the reason why that's so interesting is because just a second ago, we know, right, in the Torah, he was speaking lots and lots. He was telling about all of his dreams, he was telling all these stories, and all of a sudden he just stopped speaking, which is not characteristic of who Yosef is. So the fact that we meet Yosef in the outset, in the Mechira, that he's not speaking at all, speaks to the state of mind that Yosef was in. Now, what that state of mind looked like is a little bit unclear, right? Was it a state of mind of absolute just shock, which that seems to be an obvious one? Is it, but what type of shock is it is the real question. Is it a sense of just like, you know, I never saw this coming? Or is it just like, wow, like I knew you guys didn't like me, but I didn't realize you didn't like me that much? So that's the real question when it comes down to it. There's no real answer to that, but that would be two ways of looking at it. The only source that we do have to turn, and it's basically the last time we hear him speak to anyone in his family before the sale, and that is in source number one, where the pasuk says in Perek Lamed Zion, chapter 37, Psukim Yud Beis through Yud Gimel, where Yaakov is the one who's essentially responsible for all this happening, because he sends Yosef to his brothers, Vayelchu Achav Lir'oses Sonavi and B'Shchem, that the brothers went to go to graze their sheep in Shchem, Vayomer Yisrael, and Yaakov says to El Yosef, to his son Yosef, Halo Achicha Ruim B'Shchem. He says, you know, I think your brothers are in Shechem, and it's a little unclear where Yaakov was coming from. He must have sensed some sort of dislike and some sort of jealousy from the brothers, you would assume, towards Yosef, and so it's a little unclear what his intention was here. Maybe he was trying to have them, you know, all be friends together, because he said, Yosef, don't just sit here, you know, on the couch watching TV. Go play with your brothers. You'll see, you'll get along. So he says, Halo achicha ruim b'Shechem. Are your brothers not in Shechem? Lecha v'eshlachach aleihem. Go to them, let's see how they're doing. And what was Yosef's response? Vayomer lo hinini. He says to Yaakov, hinini. What's so fascinating when he says hinini, and the reason why I think it's so crucial to realize that, is because we see a lot of questionable actions from Yosef at a young age, and we'll continue to see some very questionable actions from him. But when he says the word hinini, you sort of conjure up the image of many of the other avos, of the other tzaddikim, when Hashem calls to them, and they say hinini, hinini, right? Or Yitzchak, when he's with his father going up to the Akedah, he says, where are you? He says, hineni, I'm here, right? So this is a word that we hear someone who is present and someone who is caring to those who are around them, and someone who is cognizant of those of what it means to of what our priority should be in life. That's who usually says this word, and so it's important to realize that at a very young age, even if he might have made mistakes, even if he might have done something's wrong throughout his life, he did have this core of hineni, that he was there and that he was ready, positioned to be the leader that he would ultimately become. But at the end of the day, right, there's not much to say about the mechira other than the fact that he had a passive role in it. He was obviously probably confused when it took place at best. And what's going to be interesting, we're not going to spend too much time thinking about it now, although we will speak about it in a couple of weeks, is what his perspective of what was taking place was. Did he realize the global picture of what was going to happen? Did he have any sort of prophecy to tell him that, okay, you know what, you're being sold by your brothers, it doesn't look too good, but keep things in consideration over here, because you will see that there will be a purpose to this? Did he have like that Gamzu Latova perspective, or was he just like totally distraught, and did he want to leave the mentality of his father's house, and did he totally want to disown anything to do with the Abrahamic traditions, because he's like, if this is what they stood for, then why would I want to be a part of this? That's going to be our big question, not for right now, but for later on. but just to keep in mind. What we're going to do now is going to speak about basically the next several events that come up in Yosef's life. We're really only going to speak about one of them because each one probably will need their own shiur. But the next major event that takes place in Yosef's life is that once he is sold into slavery and he is becomes the head of the house in the house of Potiphar. So we're going to deal with what happens in that household. Before we get there, it's just worthwhile to point out what the pattern of events is that takes place constantly in Yosef's life, and that is that he goes through this constant cycle of success and failures. Yosef is always on top, but then he goes down. He's on top again, then he goes down, right? So he starts off, we meet him, he's doing great, he's having these dreams, and he's aspiring for greatness, then his brothers sell him. He is in slavery, but then he is becomes the head of the household of Potiphar, and he is majorly successful. But then the wife accuses him of trying to do something bad with her, and he's put in prison. But then he becomes the top of the prison, but then and then he interprets the dreams, but then he's forgotten about. Then he goes, right, so constantly up and down. That is the pattern of the life of Yosef. And the truth is, there are probably two ways to take a look at that. There's the one perspective that is to say that maybe that's just what life is about, right? Everyone has ups and downs in life. True, Yosef seemed to have lots of very extreme ups and lots of very extreme downs, but that's what life could be like. So that's just, you know, one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is if you take a look at source number 2 in the book Genesis by Rabbi Grum, Rabbi Tzvi Grumet, he says as follows. He says, Joseph is successful at everything he does because God makes him successful, and everyone responsible for him recognizes his divine gift. The great irony is that the only one unaware of the source of his success is Yosef himself, right? So basically what it comes down to, that Rabbi Grumet outlines over here, is that each one of these cycles of successes and failures is this attempt by God to say, hey, Yosef, you're meant to be this great leader, so let's get you ready. Yosef says, look how great I am, I'm amazing, the success just comes to me. He doesn't necessarily see God as much as he should, and then he, as a result, he's punished, and then the whole cycle starts up again. So Yosef is the only one that doesn't realize how much Hakaras HaTov evidently he needs to have towards Hashem. The great irony is that the only one unaware of the source of his success is Yosef himself. The pattern of Yosef being thrown into the pit only to emerge more popular than before marks his life until now and continues until he ends up as second in command to Paro himself. Each down phase of Yosef's cycle is preceded by his arrogance, believing that his success is his own. God tries to get Yosef to recognize what everyone else already knows, that it is he who is responsible for Yosef's impossible success, but Yosef has a hard time getting there. In his father's house, it is those self-centered dreams, with himself as a God figure, which necessitate his being stripped of his position and his cloak, and in Potiphar's house, it is his hesitating recognition of God's role in his success, which again requires that he lose his cloak by Potiphar's wife and be tossed into a pit. Skip to the next box. Beyond battling his own arrogance, Yosef needs to recognize his own contribution to his misfortunes. Indeed, after he interprets the butler's dream positively, Joseph asks that the butler remember him and help him to be raised from his imprisonment. Listen carefully, though, to Yosef's words, for I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and here too I did nothing wrong that they placed me in this pit. Right. So in other words, what Rabbi Grumman is essentially outlining here is that Yosef takes all the credit for all the good in his life, but none of the blame for any of the bad that comes to him. He said, I just have the worst luck in the world. These terrible things keep happening to me, but all my successes, that's my own. That's how Rabbi Grumet outlines it, and that's essentially what he's trying to build over here, that these ups and downs are meant to sort of like make him into who he's meant to become. God is giving him these opportunities, and he's saying, here, Yosef, just get the picture already, and let's step in line, and let's become who you're meant to become. And then Yosef keeps making these mistakes until ultimately he no longer seems to make those mistakes because he seems to have gotten the picture, and he grows into the Yosef HaTzadik that we know so deeply. Now, the first story, like I said, is going to be speaking about the Yosef in the house of Potiphar. What I brought up in Shul, and I did not have an answer to this question, but Ari Daniel gave a beautiful answer, which I thought was very nice, and that is that the first event that we find, or the first moment that we find Yosef after he's sold by his brothers, is that he's in the house of Potiphar. It's so odd for such a figure that there's so many details of his life, not that many in the scheme of things, but certainly more in comparison to the other Avos, that there are so many details of his life that we have more than any of the other brothers. There's such detailed information. isn't it weird that we have no idea what happens to him from the time that he was sold into slavery until he gets to the house of Potiphar? Where was he? What happened? What did he go through, right? It's hard to really think about that. We have no idea what happens in that time period. And so someone suggested, Ari Daniel suggested, that it could be that this is all about realizing that it's all from God. In other words, it doesn't make a difference what happened from when he was sold to when he got to Potiphar's house, because basically it was a snap of the finger because God took care of it. Yosef didn't have to do anything. He could just take a step back and just relax, and God was going to take care of all of it. So perhaps it's basically meant to drive home this idea that Yosef did nothing to get himself here. It was God and only God who brought him to this point of success. So there are three parts in the story of Yosef being in Potiphar's house. There is the opening part in which we see him in his successful state, that Potiphar realizes that this guy is great, he knows what he's doing, and he becomes successful because of it. Number two, the part two, is when Ishis Potiphar decides that her eye catches him, and she really likes how he looks, and she thinks that he's great, so she wants to be with him. And part number three is when he says, heck no, and he flees, and he is punished because of that. And so, part number one, take a look at source number three. It's Perek Lamed Tes, chapter 39, Psukim, Beis through Vav. So, the Lord was with Yosef, and he was a successful man, and he stayed in the house of his Egyptian master. And when his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord lent success, to everything he undertook, he took a liking to Yosef. He made him his personal attendant and put him in charge of his household, placing in his hands all that he owned. And from the time that the Egyptian put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed his house for Yosef's sake, so that the blessing of the Lord was upon everything that he owned in the house and outside. He left all that he had in Yosef's hands, and with him there he paid attention to nothing save the food that he ate. Now Yosef was well built and handsome. So the first thing you notice from this opening paragraph, these opening few psukim, is the fact that Hashem's name comes up an awful lot, right? It helps that in this translation, it's, Lord is in caps, so you can really see it. But essentially, you have five times in five psukim that Hashem's name is mentioned. That's kind of out of the ordinary. But again, it's driving home this idea that God is very involved in Yosef's life. God is front and center in trying to set up what is meant to be, the details of Yosef's life. And again, there are two ways to look at that. There is to say that Hashem takes an invested interest because he knows who Yosef is supposed to become. But you can look at it the way that I prefer to look at it, and that is that is exactly how involved God is in everyone's life. And sometimes you just have to look for it. Yosef did not realize, perhaps, that God was that involved, and maybe there are some of us who don't always realize how involved God is in our own lives. Source number four is interesting, basically, in the context of us saying that Yosef did not realize the fact that God was so heavily involved, because Rashi says ki Hashem ito, that shem shamayim shagur b'fiv, that the name of God, or that Yosef would always invoke God's name. Now that's a very interesting idea. What does that mean that Yosef would invoke God's name? It's hard to really understand what that means if we're going to say that he didn't realize that God was involved. So it could be that he went around and said things like God willing and like Bezrat Hashem, but maybe he didn't mean it, but he was like I don't want to make fun of anyone, but someone who like thinks they're from but not really from, but they always say, they always put God's name in there, but they don't actually mean it. So maybe that could be, but it's hard to really say that. So it's a little unclear if when Rabbi Grummet is making his point about saying that Yosef did not realize that God was with him, which seems to be a pretty understandable perspective, if that works with this Rashi, or maybe it's just antithetical to what Rashi is saying. Maybe Rashi is saying, no, Yosef did see God. Maybe Yosef was cognizant that God was there. He still seems to have made some mistakes and maybe took too much credit at times and put too much of the blame elsewhere. But nonetheless, maybe he did actually have a real perspective that God was with him. Regardless, whatever it was, Potiphar certainly saw that God was with him, and you'd have to assume on some level that's because Yosef would talk about him, because how would Potiphar know who God is? It's hard to think that any of the Egyptians and any of these peoples who bow down to other gods, that they knew who God was, right? That's the whole story when the Jewish people come out of Egypt, that they're introduced to this God that they never knew about. So probably Potiphar only knew about him from Yosef, but unclear exactly how much Yosef really ascribed to God's help. Then we have the question of this last pasuk that we quoted, that Vayehi Yosef Yufei Toar Vifei Mar'eh, that Yosef was a very attractive young man. Now, there's a machlokas why this line is over here. There is the perspective that's well known from Rashi, in which Rashi spares no words over here, and when he quotes the Medrash, source number 6, we'll go back to the Radak in a second, but in source number 6, Rashi says, Kevan Shera Atzmo Moshel, Yosef was living the good life. This was a guy who, again, not too long ago, he was great in his household, in his family's house, but then he was sold into slavery. Life was rough for a little bit. But then he was sold into this Potiphar's house. He became so successful, and life was rich again. He could put his feet up, and he could enjoy, and he had people working under him. He was the head of the household. He was in charge. But then what happens? Hischil ochel v'shoseh mesalsel basaro. He felt so good and confident about his position. He started eating steak dinners, and he started drinking wine, and he started doing his hair. He went to the beauty parlor. Unbelievable, this guy Yosef. And so what happens? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Avicha Misabel, V'ata Misalsel Basarecha. Your father is sitting in mourning because he thinks that you're dead, and you're going to go curl your hair. Unbelievable. Ani Migare V'cha Esadov. I love this line. I always love this line. He says, I'm going to send the bear after you. The bear is Eshes Potiphar. Miyad, I'm going to send her right after you, and she's going to go after you. Essentially, the way Rashi frames it over here is that Yosef is being punished. Yosef did not realize that he was not acting appropriately, and then therefore he was punished, and that's why the whole incident of Eshes Potiphar takes place. The Radak doesn't seem to take it that way. He basically just frames it as a cause and effect. Amar zeh lefisha amar v'tisa Eshes Adonav. Why are we told that Yosef is beautiful? Because of the fact that Eshes Potiphar is about to get really excited about him. You're going to ask yourself, why would she be so excited about him? Oh, because he was such a good-looking young man. Now, what's so odd about that comment is that it's not so hard to believe that she'd be so excited about him. You could picture it for a second. If we don't know what ancient Egypt looked like, we've certainly seen enough movies that we hopefully depict it somewhat well. But you can imagine, right? Potiphar was off doing business. He was a statesman. He was involved in lots of work. He was never home. But then he decided to leave his household in the hands of a very young, capable, strapping man. What did he do? He cooked. He cleaned. He did everything. He took care of everyone. Is it so hard to believe that Potiphar would be attracted to him? Forget about his looks. He was a great guy. He took care of everything. He took care of everyone. So the fact that the Radak says that it's just a cause and effect, it might be a little hard to believe. And when you frame it like that, Rashi makes a lot of sense. Because you don't need to hear that she's attracted to him. It makes a lot of sense she'd be attracted to him, regardless of his looks. It certainly helps. But regardless of the looks, it's not such a crazy idea. So therefore, to say that it's a punishment, and that's why we're told that he looks good, that in some ways makes a lot of sense. And it quotes the Medrash, and Rashi certainly always like to subscribe or quote the rabbis and their perspective versus other ideas. But nonetheless, that is the machlokas between Rashi and the Radak. Nachama Leibowitz in source number 7 makes this same point as well. She's the one who frames this machlokas. Take a look. We'll jump around a little bit, but we'll read her words briefly. Surely this does not constitute an appropriate moment for describing Yosef's physical attractiveness. And, right? So in other words, what she's trying to say over here is that when you introduce a character in Tanakh, sometimes you'll be told that this person was very beautiful. We never just, in the middle of hearing about someone, are told that they're beautiful. It's like such a weird non sequitur, right? In any case, it is unusual for the Torah to go into such details unless at the beginning, when the person is first introduced to us. In our case, however, the Torah has long ago described the fortunes of Yosef from his childhood in Canaan to his entering Egypt as a slave, and only now, after he had become promoted to the highest position in the household of an Egyptian dignitary, are we told of his physical appearance. Advocates of the plain sense of the text offer the simple explanation that this description is a prelude to the story of his seduction by Potiphar's wife, right, that's the Radak, emphasizing that she became infatuated with him just because of his looks. It is simply a case of cause and effect, our verse providing the cause for the episode related in the immediately succeeding verses. Our sages, however, discovered another significance in it. They found in it an indication of Yosef's reactions to the dramatic changes in his fortunes and environment, and then she quotes the Rashi, then we'll skip that because we read that already. According to this interpretation, then, Yosef was enamored of the new life of luxury that he was living living in Egypt, the country of wealth and culture, and his eyes were blinded to the unreal nature of the power that had been placed in his hands. He forgot his slavery and that he was a stranger amongst them. He forgot the spiritual chasm separating him as a son of Abraham and follower of his way of life from Egypt and its abominations, and began to become more attached to the values of his employer, which the Torah describes, etc., etc. She goes on. I don't bring it all here, but that's the in a nutshell. And we normally assume that Yosef was like the first modern Orthodox Jew, meaning that he was the first one who was able, well, that's not a good way to put it, actually. He was the first Jew who was able to successfully live in exile, right? That he managed to incorporate the incredible lessons that he learned in his family, in the Abrahamic traditions, and he was able to keep them and apply them to his sons, Menashe and Ephraim. That's why some of the commentaries will say later on, when Yaakov sees Menashe and Ephraim, he's like, whoa, who are these amazing people? He realizes they're his grandsons who were the first Jews that were born in Egypt, and they were such great people. So we normally assume that Yosef was this great guy and he continued the traditions and he taught them to his sons. But at this point, it's a little bit unclear exactly where Yosef was. Maybe he was ready to throw out the whole tradition that he got from his father's household because he was fed up. Listen, he was sold, he was thrown out of the house, and now here he is in this new household and where he's living the high life. So maybe he's ready to throw it all out. By the way, just to mention, parallel to all of this is Yehuda. If you remember Yehuda, who is also Yehuda and Yosef have many parallel experiences in their lives, in that they both sort of have these intense, you know, growth moments. And so with Yehuda, in this same moment, Yehuda was also experiencing this idea that he sort of felt rejected by his family, right? That we said, I think the pasuk is by Yerid Yehuda, that Yehuda went down. And some explain he went down because his family was, all the brothers were blaming him because they saw how mad that their father was, that he no longer had Yosef. So Yehuda also experienced this questionable perspective with his own traditions, if he's going to keep up with the family. But anyway, so back to Yosef. So that's how we were supposed to view the opening scene of with Yosef in Potiphar's house. Either it's that, you know, God helped him, and either it's that Yosef was then going to be punished, or rather that the verse is stated there just as a cause and effect, and that's why we're told that he's beautiful. Part two is, as we explained, it's when Yosef's Potiphar takes a liking to Yosef, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on this, I guess now and towards the end of this year. But specifically, you have to wonder why we're given the information we are about Ashes Potiphar. When I say that, I mean we're not given much information about her, except for bad things. First of all, we don't even know her name, which, you know, for someone to not be given their name, that's always a statement in the Torah that we're not, that you're not important enough for us to tell you your name. You are the wife of someone. Okay, it's a good question. You could ask, why is Bas Paro only Bas Paro, right? Vatia, right? Basi is the name given by the Medrash. But in general, so it's an interesting move that the Torah makes when it doesn't give someone's name, and we don't have a Potiphar's wife's name. We just know that she is Potiphar's wife. It's almost ironic the Torah wants us to call her Potiphar's wife, because she clearly was not the most loyal of wives, in that she was ready to be with the first guy that she was with, that came to the house. And we'll speak about that a little bit more in a moment. But just to realize that the context of Ashes Potiphar and her husband Potiphar is that they probably did not have the strongest marriage, and that will outline now. So take a look at source number 8, Parak Lamates, Psukim Zion through Yudbeis. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes upon Yosef and said, "Lie with me." But he refused. He said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here, my master gives no thought to anything in this house, and all that he owns he has placed in my hands. He wields no more authority in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except yourself, since you are his wife. How then could I do this most wicked thing and sin before God?" And by the way, just as a contrast, the previous psukim mentioned God 5 times. We only have God once here. "And much as she coaxed Yosef day after day, he did not yield to her request to lie beside her, to be with her. One such day he came into the house to do his work. None of the household being there inside, she caught hold of him by his garment and said, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garments in her hand and got away and fled outside." The major question we have to ask over here is, did Yosef want this to happen, or was he really upset with this? And naturally, we always grew up with the idea, or we're told, you know, that Yosef really didn't want this to happen. It was a hard Yitzhara to fight. Okay, the woman is throwing himself at him, so it's, you know, any young man would struggle with this, but that he was really so strong and he got through it, and that's because of the Medrash in source number 9, the famous idea that Rav Huna b'shem Rav Masna ikonin shel aviv ra'a v'tzinim damo. One perspective says that Yosef saw the image of his father in his mind, or in a mirror, or in the reflection, whatever, and his blood got cold in, meaning that helped him, you know, sort of cool down a little bit. The other less known opinion quoted is that he didn't see his father, but that he saw his mother. Rabbi Menachama b'shem Rabbi Ami Amar Ikonin shel Imo Ra'a b'sinei damo. Actually, he saw Rachel Imenu in his eye, in his reflection or in his mind, and that sort of helped him cool down to not violate the sin. And again, our perspective has always been, when learning that medrash, practically, that he really wanted to avoid this sin. He was tried hard by the Yitzhahara, but he was able to defeat the Yitzhahara. And that's how Nechama Price puts it in source number 10. She frames it that this is called virtuous Yosef. Rabbinic tradition labels Yosef as righteous. He is called Yosef HaTzadik, an appellation he earns because he never sins or wavers in his beliefs and values in Egypt, even in his encounter with Potiphar's wife. Therefore, according to tradition, Yosef refuses her advances. On that specific day, he expects other people to be in Potiphar's home, hence he is caught off guard by her approach. In an instant, she begins to undress him, and desperate to escape the situation, Yosef removes his outer garment and runs from the room. In this understanding of the story, Yosef demonstrates his faith and maturity even at this early stage. That's one perspective. That's the classical one. However, the other way to frame it, as Nechama puts it, is flirting with power, Yosef. Take a look at this. However, there is an alternative approach to the encounter and past encounters between Yosef and the wife of Potiphar. Yosef may refuse her advances, but in a manner that encourages her to continue her attempts at a relationship. Right, Potiphar, H.S. Potiphar, you know, I can't, I really shouldn't, I don't think we should do this, but okay, keep talking. Right, that constant back and forth, that constant, you know, question mark that he was putting out there. And that question mark gave her the opening to keep trying. Hence, he is fine being alone in the house with her on that specific day. Okay, listen, maybe she'll put some advances on me, she'll put the moves, all right, I'll keep refusing, but I don't mind it too much. The Talmud states that he refrains from sinning with her only because he envisions the image of his father. Evidently, it took this vision to force him to cease being there with her, right? Meaning, we look at it as like, wow, he's so incredible. He conjured up the image of his father, and so that he wouldn't sin. The other way to say it is that the only thing that stopped him from sinning is that he thought of his father, and then he felt too terrible. But otherwise, he was ready to go, but he needed that to stop him. But he was ready to do it. He hastily runs instead of walking out of the room to prevent the evil inclination from overwhelming him. According to this approach, his subsequent fall from Potiphar's home reflects his second significant lapse in judgment. Perhaps now he will finally mature, right? Meaning, the first lapse in judgment is when he told his brothers about all of his dreams, and he didn't take the social cue that they were really upset with him, and he just kept egging them on. And now he again messes up in that he continues to egg on Asus Potiphar, and as a result, God places him in jail now to allow him the time to learn what he should have already known from his experience with his brothers after being thrown into the pit and sold as a slave. So essentially, these are the two ways to look at Yosef. Was he egging her on, or was he really trying to prevent her from being with him? And I think the jury is still out. I think you can look at it in either way, right? At the end of the day, I always personally like the more traditional way of looking at things. When Chazal say things, you know, I like to take it at face value. So, but nonetheless, there is another perspective out there. The final scene in source number 11 is when Potiphar then screams, and she says, you know, honey, you brought this boy to my house, and he tried to be with me, and then Potiphar punishes him. But let's see how Potiphar reacts, and let's even see how Asius Potiphar reacts, and maybe take note of how there are very few other players involved here, which seems odd. Okay, source number 11. When she saw that he had left it in her hand and had fled outside, she called out to her servants and said to them, look, he had to bring us a Hebrew to dally with us. This one came to lie with me, but I screamed loud. And when he heard me screaming at the top of my voice, he left his garment with me and got away and fled outside. She kept his garments beside her until his master came home. Then she told him the story, saying, the Hebrew slave whom you brought into our house came to me to dally with me, but when I screamed at the top of my voice, he left his garments with me and fled outside. When his master heard the story that his wife told him, namely, thus and so your slave did to me, he was furious. So Yosef's master had put him in prison, where the king's prisoners were confined. But even while he was there in prison, the Lord was with Yosef, etc. And we'll speak a little bit about his prison experience next week. But take a look at this scene. What do you notice about Asius Potiphar? You know, there are a few ways to read this, and if you don't read it closely, you're going to probably miss some points. But that is that if you were the wife of the president of the United States, which, okay, she wasn't, but she was the wife of a senator or something like that. And someone in the household tried to be intimate with her against her will. Don't you think that there would have been some servants that would have run to Potiphar to get him, or you know, called the police or something? What happens? She screams and Yosef runs. All the servants are like, oh, here we go again. We've seen this act before. This is Aishas Potiphar. She's known for these kinds of things. How much is she known for these kinds of things? She had to hold on to Yosef's clothes to bring proof to Potiphar. Look at what he did. You wouldn't believe me otherwise, but look at what he did. But here's the truth. The one holding on to the other person's clothes, that's a pretty, it doesn't look too good for them. The fact that she was holding on to Yosef's clothes just makes her look like what she probably was, which was someone who this was not the first time this happened to. Yosef is not the first head of the household. Maybe Potiphar even brought Yosef in and made him the head of the household, because not only was he good at what he did, but he was also a man of God. A man who probably would not want to be with his wife like this and try to seduce her like this, which he might have experienced previously. There's a lot of subtext to assume that that could be the case. And because of that, you'll have to wonder, well, what was Potiphar doing punishing Yosef so severely? And with that, maybe you can say that he wasn't punishing him severely, right? How did Yosef end up becoming so successful in prison? How did things go well for him? Well, Potiphar, if he really knew what was going on, he might have felt bad for Yosef. He might have said, I love this guy. He was so good to me. He was such a good servant. And now my crazy wife, she went at it again and she tried to get him, but he was such a loyal servant. What am I going to do? So he has to put him in prison because... it would not look right for his wife to cry wolf and him to say, you know, look the other way. He had to put her in prison. I had to put him in prison, but what was he going to do? And so therefore, perhaps what happened was Potiphar said to the head warden, treat this guy nicely. And maybe as a result of that, Yosef understood that that's what took place. And he said, I'm living the good life. Why did Yosef think he was living the good life? And so this is going to be the major question we're going to focus on next week. Did he realize or did he think that God had anything to do with it? Or did he just say, maybe it was Potiphar? Maybe it was my good reputation. Otherwise, other than Aishas Potiphar, everyone loved me and thought I was such a great guy. Maybe that's why I'm so successful. And if we think about it like that, it's not so hard to understand why Yosef maybe didn't see God anymore at this point, if he did not. So that's going to be what we're going to focus on next week. Following that, we are going to speak a little bit about, or a lot about, I guess you should say, after he's out of prison and his time with Paro and his time with the brothers. But all of that is to come. For now, we wish everyone a beautiful night and a Shavua Tov.